Shaw Brothers logo, the symbol of quality. I'm not sure if there's another studio logo that has inspired as much excitement with a certain degree of fans across the world as Shaw Brothers and the Shaw Scope. That's actually the third logo that they had. The other two were a little bit simpler. That one was introduced in 1958. Which is really when Shaw Brothers, as we know it, began, even though the brothers Run Jay, Run May, Run Day, and Run Run involvement in film dates back to 1925. They produced films from 1958 to 1987. Kind of got sidetracked by their investment in the TVB television studio, which was launched in 1967. So they, generally speaking, shut down production in 87 and ultimately dissolved into other entities by 2011. This is Mighty Peking Man. My name is Travis Crawford. I'm a film journalist and former festival programmer. In fact, one of the highlights when I programmed for the Philadelphia Film Festival was a retrospective that we did on the Shaw Brothers in like 2003, 2004. It was when Celestial had first started to restore and remaster their films. We screened 36 Chamber of Shaolin, Vengeance, Come Drink With Me, Intimate Confessions of a Chinese Courtesan, and one or two others. And it was wonderfully received by the festival audiences then. Mighty Peking Man, it's a unusual film. It's obviously an attempt to duplicate the success of Dino De Laurentiis' American remake of King Kong that had been released the previous year, 1976. Mighty Peking Man's from 1977. A little bit more about Shaw Brothers before we get into the film in question. Obviously, this is not the place for a complete history of the studio, but suffice to say, they made about 1,000 films. I think about 3/4 of those have already been restored by Celestial. At one time, they had one of the largest studios in the world in terms of, you know, production backlot facilities, and certainly the largest in Asia. And indeed, this film makes great use of all those sets. We'll be talking about that in more detail as we go on. You know, they certainly changed the face of film, not just in Hong Kong, not just in Asia, but around the world forever. I mean, as I said, when the logo came up, they are one of the most beloved studios. In the 70s, they did face competition from television, and has been noted before, Golden Harvest as an up-and-coming studio at that point in the 70s. In 1977, when Mighty Peking Man was made, they slightly reduced the number of productions from the previous year in 1976. Well, they had really peaked in terms of production from about 1967 to 1976. And in 76, they made, I think, almost 50 productions, which is an average of virtually one theatrical release a week at that time. They did scale back a little bit in 77. Mighty Peking Man, I mean, it's also an attempt to reach an international audience as a result of the success of King Kong. Although it's interesting, and I'll talk about this in a minute, the film took almost 3 years to come out in the U.S. and did not come out through, you know, any one of the major distributors or anything like that. It was through World Northol, which I'll get into in a minute. But at that time, too, the Shaw Brothers, shortly after this, were also getting involved in international co-productions like Meteor and most famously Blade Runner, although neither one of those two were much of a success in their initial releases. So that kind of put the, you know, damper on those proceedings in terms of doing international co-productions. Some of the other films from Shaw Brothers in 77 that are, you know, most noteworthy are obviously Lau Kar Lung's Executioners from Shaolin. It's also called Executioners of Death. I'm going to come back to that, though, because I want to talk for a second, and you're going to hear me shuffling notes here, about an actor that you see in this, in the forefront there, Norman Choi, or Norman Chu, Choi Soo Kung. He is a very popular, there he is in the striped tie. And I want to talk about him early only because he's a very big actor in Shaw Brothers films throughout this period, although he dies pretty early in this one. I'm not giving anything away. I'm sure you've seen the movie. 15 or 20 minutes, and he's one of the guys that goes off the cliff. This is Danny Lee, of course, and we'll come back to him. But Norman Choi, Norman Chu, was he plays Ah Lung, Dr. Ah Lung in this film. He was born in 1955 in Hong Kong. He was a Shaw Brothers contract player right off the bat at the age of 17 or 18. And he was an action star for the most part. He has just sort of a small character role in this film. He's been in about 150 films. He's still working now. Again, he started out young in Savage Five and Heroes of the Underground, both in 1973. Moved on to do two big movies, including some by this director, Flying Guillotine and Black Magic in 1975. 76, he was in Killer Clans, Magic Blade, Web of Death. You know, it's funny, I'm going to start to say a lot of the same film titles over again when we look at the collaborators in this film, the director, the writer, the actors. But it's not any kind of, Scorsese, Paul Schrader, Robert De Niro kind of intimate collaboration relationship over time. They were just all very prolific, hardworking Shaw Brothers under contract during this period. They were very prolific. They worked all the time. So they just happened to, their paths happened to intersect. Going to go back to Norman Choi in a second. This is India. We'll talk about the Indian locations in a second. But anyway, going back to Norman, in addition to this film in 77, he had other big films, Clans of Intrigue, Jade Tiger, Death Duel. And then, of course, the incredible 36 Chamber of Shaolin, also known as Master Killer in the U.S. in the following year, 78, which many people, myself included, consider one of the best Shaw Brothers films. He did 14 films alone in 1978. Shaolin Mantis, Dirty Kung Fu, Clan of Amazons. Then moving into the 80s, he was in the landmark early Choi Hark horror comedy, We Are Going to Eat You. He was in Demigods and Demi-Devils, Duel to the Death, another Choi Hark classic, Zoo Warriors for Magic Mountain, Hong Kong Godfather, Lucky Stars Go Places, the action comedy, part of that series. He's in a legendary horror film from Shaw Brothers in 1983 that I'll be talking about in more detail later, Seating of a Ghost, which is certainly incredible. He's in the 1987 version of Golden Swallow. And then also in the 80s, he's in the fantastic, another movie that's going to come up quite a bit, the Lau Kar Lung Chow Yun-Fat action movie, Tiger on the Beat, as well as the sequel. He's in that as well. Sun Chung's film City War. He's in a 1991, moving into the 90s. Also, he's in an early Stephen Chow comedy, King of Beggars. Stephen Chow, we'll talk about in a little bit too, and his relation to Danny Lee. Norman Choi is also in the Anita Moy Tearjerker, Au Revoir, Mon Amour from 1991. The Wong Jing sort of action comedy, Legend of Liquid Sword. The Michelle Yeoh action film Wing Chun. Isn't a weird kind of now, I don't want to say totally neglected or forgotten, but a strange Choi Hark produced fantasy called Magic Crane. And he worked less often in the 21st century, but he made some pretty interesting career choices and was in some great films. He was in a later Leslie Cheung film, The Ghost Story Inner Senses from 2002, which was one of Cheung's last films. He's in an excellent 2004 triad drama by Wong Ching-Po called Jiang Hu. Blanking out on what the American retitling of that one is. He co-stars with Josie Ho in Edmund Pang's great horror satire Dream Home from 2010. And then just the last couple years, 2020, 2021, he's been in Taoist Priest and White-Haired Devil Lady, neither one of which I've seen, so I'll leave you to investigate those. Now, coming back to Shaw Brothers in 1977, the year Mighty Peking Man was made, I was talking about some of their other notable films from that era. Executioners from Shaolin, aka Executioners of Death, Shaolin Executioners. Great, one of my favorites, the Chang Che film, Chinatown Kid, which is partially shot in San Francisco. I mean, that's a classic. Also, they did Shor Yun's Clans of Intrigue with Tai Lung, and also by the same director, Brave Archer. And then another big one that year was the adaptation. There have been a few, but the 77 adaptation of Dream of the Red Chamber with Bridget Lin and Sylvia Chang. This stuff here is partially shot, all this footage, in the town of Mysore, India. Although, and I think it's pretty clear to see, if you're seeing wide shots, particularly those with elephants and leopards and tigers, that is in India, but that's intercut with a lot of close-up shots of stuff that's done back at the Shaw Brothers lot in Hong Kong. And, of course, there's some shoddy, somewhat not great-looking rear projection. We're going to talk about that in conjunction with the effects. Also, when the elephant was stomping some of the people there in the huts, I'm a little reluctant to point this out, but I guess it probably should be pointed out that that stuff was shot back at the Shaw Brothers studios. Again, those insert close-ups, and those are Hong Kong stuntmen in brown face to more closely resemble the Indian extras in the film. Going to come back to India and the location stuff in a second, but Mighty Peking Man is kind of a difficult film to talk about because the style of the film, the approach, and this is true whether you see it dubbed in English or whether you see it in Mandarin with subtitles, is very hyperbolic and melodramatic and over the top in a way that I think is often, I don't want to say mischaracterized, but simplistically reduced in a lot of criticism of films like this to being camp, you know. And admittedly, there are moments in the film, you know, the slow motion run with Danny Lee and Evelyn Kraft falling in love and, you know, the leopard there, that do come perilously close to almost seeming like a you know, a parody of that type of material, something you would see in, you know, Russ Meyer's Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, for example. Perhaps it's no accident that that film's writer, the critic Roger Ebert, was a big fan of Mighty Peking Man when it came out. But the funny thing is, sometimes when things are played very broadly, like the way the melodrama and the emotional scenes in Mighty Peking Man are played, the pitch that they're aimed at, I hate to use the analogy, even a stopped clock is right twice a day, but the thing is, when you're hitting that big, sometimes I think that the film is genuinely emotionally affecting. And I think that that's true of films like Mighty Peking Man. I mean, as much as there's a tendency to, you know, I really don't like that kind of Mystery Science Theater 3000 Golden Turkey Awards kind of condescending, derisive, you know, laughter at films like this, even though I know that a lot of people fall into that. And don't get me wrong, Mighty Peking Man is a very funny movie at times. I mean, there are some, you know, definite laugh-inducing stuff in there. But I think also, you know, you shouldn't hold the movie at that kind of a distance and an ironic detachment, because I do think there's, you know, material in the film that is played very operatically and yet I think does work and can be unexpectedly moving and genuine. So, you know, that's my take on the film. I think that, you know, it plays big, but oftentimes it does so with genuine results. Okay, getting back to the Indian stuff here. Again, it was shot in Mysore, India. When you see the wide shots in the buildings and the animals, but a lot of this stuff, like, you know, the more intimate scenes, like these three actors here, that's just, you know, back on the Shaw Brothers lot. Cost $6 million to make. Some of its other titles, well, the title Mandarin Sing Sing Wong translates to King of Gorillas or Gorilla King. It was released as Goliathon in the U.S. Let me just interject about the U.S. release. It did come out in 1980, almost 3 years after the film was done. I don't know whether Shaw Brothers necessarily had higher hopes for it reaching a wider audience with a bigger company. It came out in the U.S. through WW Films through World Northal. World Northal was an odd distributor. They were out of Manhattan. They handled a lot of the Shaw Brothers stuff, the legendary stuff, Five Deadly Venoms, 36 Chamber of Shaolin. Again, it was called Master Killer, Black Magic, the horror film, which is going to come up quite a lot in this commentary. Flying Guillotine, another one that we're going to mention a lot. But they also did a lot of art house stuff, the Italian film Bread and Chocolate, Peter Weir's The Last Wave, the theatrical version of Alan Clark's Scum all came out in the U.S. through World Northal. I love that tiger taking off the leg gag right there. That's tremendous. Came out in European territories as a Colossus of Congo, which is odd considering the film is, you know, partially set in India, not the Congo. But yeah, so anyway, Indian material here, and it was designed to, you know, try and duplicate the success, although that success was a little bit mixed, of King Kong by Dino De Laurentiis the previous year. It's interesting because it was one of, I'd say probably three or four films around 1976, 77 that did that. But if you go back into the 60s, there's actually a surprising history of sort of King Kong styled films that enjoyed a revival throughout the 60s in various countries several years before Dino De Laurentiis had any plans to remake the film. The original King Kong, of course, came out in 1933 and was a massive hit, so much so, in fact, that they rushed out a sequel, Son of Kong, which was not nearly as successful within the same year as King Kong's release. And while there have been, you know, certainly crazy giant ape and monster movies that were made throughout the decades since, it's interesting, as I said, that in the 60s, there was a little bit of a boon in sort of Kong-like films from various countries. Probably the first one out of gate was the British film Konga with Michael Gough from 1961. There's an Indian film, a Bollywood movie from 1963 called Shikari. The best one is probably the 1966 Japanese film from Toho, War of the Gargantuas, which is actually a sequel. And that one is really worth seeking if you haven't seen that already. It's a 1969 film, an American movie called Mighty Gorga by the director David Hewitt, who... this is not a good film, but David Hewitt did do some interesting stuff elsewhere in his career, particularly the sort of audience participation 1965 kids matinee spectacle, Monsters Crash, The Pajama Party, which has lived on in infamy as a something weird DVD in the years since then. There's an odd 1968 Italian film. It was released in the U.S. as King of Kong Island, which is an incredibly misleading title. And unfortunately, I cannot remember the Italian title right now, but I think it involves Eva, who is the sort of Tarzana jungle woman at the center of the film, although she's more of a supporting character than a lead in that movie. But that she sort of has a similarity to the Evelyn Craft character that's coming up in a bit in Mighty Peking Man. I think those were the 60s films I was trying to think of, but right around the time the Dino De Laurentiis King Kong remake in 1976, the Shaw Brothers were not the only one who had an idea of sort of piggybacking on that that remake. There is a movie that I think actually beat the De Laurentiis film into theaters by a couple months in fall of 76 called Ape, which is oddly a co-production between the U.S. and South Korea. I'm not sure how South Korea got roped into that one. It's directed by Paul Leiter, who's better known for kind of an interesting 70s horror movie called I Dismember Mama. It was memorable not just because of the title, but because it has a kind of a creepy undercurrent to it. Yes, Paul Leiter, incidentally, director of Ape, is the father of the big blockbuster director Mimi Leiter. Also from 76, and I think released this literally the same month as the Dino De Laurentiis film, is a British movie. I think it was a co-production between the UK and Germany. A spoof called Queen Kong, directed by Frank Agrama, who's the Egyptian-born director who also did the gore film, the 80s Dawn of the Mummy, which is better than Queen Kong. Queen Kong is a, as I said, a parody with Robin Asquith and Valerie Leon, both of whom have been in better fare than Queen Kong. But if you're going to see one other film from 76 and 77 that rips off the Dino De Laurentiis film, here we see Danny Lee encountering Mighty Peking Man. I'm going to come back to that other movie I was just about to mention, but I do want to say that the effects in Mighty Peking Man, and we'll talk about them in more detail, I think are kind of a mixed bag. I mean, right there we see the weak link in the effects is the rear projection stuff. Although that's not, you know, specific to this film or the Shaw Brothers films. I mean, rear projection in a lot of 70s movies was about on par with this. I mean, certainly it's better in some films, it's worse in some films. That is the weak link in the effects. However, the stuff with, first of all the models and miniatures, and that has a little bit in the Indian village stuff here at the beginning, but comes into play really at the climax in Hong Kong. Oh, and here swinging on the vine is Evelyn Kraft. We have to talk about her in a minute, but I'm already like three tangents in, so we're going to have to come back to Evelyn Kraft. The greatest stuff in the film effects-wise, the miniatures and the models, and also I think the guy in the suit stuff, and I'm going to talk about the Japanese effects artist behind that, is also really good. I wish they had not used, I think, some of the close-ups right there, for example, of Mighty Peking Man's face, where it's a animatronic puppet head. I don't think those work nearly as well because the eyes just seem dead. You know, when you have the man in the suit, you know, you have really expressive eyes behind the mask. And I think that that stuff works really well in terms of, and so that's how I would break down the effects. Rear projection, a little disappointing. A lot of the other effects, I think, stand up really well. And this was a very slick production in terms of effects for Shaw Brothers at the time. But going back to what I was saying, again, I always try to remember and double back. If you're going to see one other 1977 imitation of the Dino De Laurentiis film, make sure it's the truly incredible Italian movie Yeti, Giant of the 20th Century, which is not nearly as good as Mighty Peking Man as a movie overall, but is almost as much of a surreal viewing experience. It's from director Gianfranco Parolini, and it also has a, much like the Evelyn Kraft character in this movie, kind of a Tarzana jungle girl figure in the movie, played by the actress Antonella Interlenghi, who some of you may know more for playing the role of Emily in the Lucia Fulci horror film City of the Living Dead, also known as Gates of Hell. So yeah, I mean, there have been a ton of Kong ripoffs. And then, of course, this is not even getting into the 2005 Peter Jackson remake with Naomi Watts. And then all of the Kong, Godzilla, Skull Island stuff that's come out as huge Hollywood blockbusters in more recent years to varying degrees of success. I think some of them are okay. I don't know why this is such a prominent recurring storyline. The ape and the blonde woman specifically, whether it's Fay Wray or Evelyn Kraft or Jessica Lange or Naomi Watts, it's kind of an enigma to me. There obviously are a lot of sexual undercurrents. Interestingly, if you look at Mighty Peking Man, which also reverses the sort of jungle Tarzan and civilized Jane dynamic between the male and female leads in the film, Danny Lee and Evelyn Kraft, you could also make the argument that the sexual politics between the Evelyn Kraft character and the giant ape are comparatively progressive, given that their interaction seems to be on equal footing and consensual, if you want to use that word. I mean, you know, when you look at the De Laurentiis King Kong the previous year with Jessica Lange as the blonde figure and the ape, The sexual element there that was present as an undercurrent in the 1933 version is, of course, as you would expect from a 76 movie, brought out very much to the forefront. And in fact, there's a scene in the 76 King Kong where the Charles Grodin character directly says to Jessica Lange that the ape tried to rape you, he says to her, which is kind of a startling moment in the movie, particularly considering the delivery of the dialogue is sort of played for comedy that's not really present. And but no, the relationship between Evelyn Kraft as the Jungle Girl and Mighty Peking Man is again progressive, consensual, however you want to talk about it. Again, I don't really get the appeal of it, but the appeal is one that has lasted over the decades and in films from all over the world, as I, you know, was just talking about with all the Kong imitations. There is a 2002 book by the Dutch literary theorist Stein Jensen called, and no, I'm not making this title up, called Why Women Love Apes, that you can actually find a little bit to read online. And she talks about the appeal of this Freudian fantasy. Incidentally, just to interject, I kind of like this little moment here with Danny Lee showing her the photos of her as a child with her parents before the plane accident, and how this transitions into, I was talking earlier about, you know, the very kind of exaggerated, bigger than life, over the top style of the film. And you really, really see that played out in the extreme in this whole flashback sequence, which is as non-subtle and as direct and, you know, aggressive as you can get with the fire effects superimposed and the music. And we're going to talk about the music in greater detail in a little bit. But yeah, I think that, you know, and that's one thing in the film where, you know, the economy and bluntness of the storytelling, I think it actually very much aids the film throughout this whole flashback sequence. You know, I've said it before, this movie is 45 minutes shorter than the 1976 King Kong and about 46 times more entertaining than that film. Although I kind of like the 76 King Kong too, but I do prefer the approach of Mighty Peking Man. Anyway, going back to that book, Why Women Love Apes, she charts that from that cultural phenomenon from the 1933 King Kong to a 1996 Danish novel by Peter Hoag, which I have not read, called The Woman and the Ape, which has sort of a cinematic twin with a 1986 film, French film, but by the Japanese director Nagisa Oshima, who's best known for In the Realm of the Senses, as well as being one of the key figures of the Japanese New Wave of the 60s. That film is Max Mona Moore, which stars Charlotte Rampling as sort of this ideal bourgeois wife who falls in love, literally, with a chimpanzee. And apparently that's also a similar plot to that Danish novel, Woman and the Ape, that I mentioned, which also depicts a love affair between, I think the character is an anthropologist's wife or something like that, who feels neglected by her husband and begins an affair with one of the monkeys that he's studying. Jensen, in her book, kind of talks about it as you know, sort of an exploration of masculine insecurities about, you know, men feeling that they're, you know, quote unquote, not man enough and being replaced by literally, you know, an ape in the jungle. I mean, the wildest of primate species, and that it taps into, you know, male insecurities more than it does any kind of like Freudian female fantasies. But it's an interesting book, one worth reading, particularly thinking about films like this, as well as all the other Kong ripoffs. Just pausing for a moment, speaking of sexual symbolism and trying to see if this is the moment where... No, that comes a little bit later on. Never mind. But since we're seeing so much of Evelyn Kraft, let me talk a little bit about her. And I didn't mean seeing so much of her in the physical sense. I just, you know, in terms of costuming, I just meant in terms of her character. Oh, by the way, before I get into her background, the shot of her going up the tree like that was apparently achieved in reverse. She's actually scuttling down the tree, which you see again in, you know, real motion in a moment. And the tree is also at a more of a horizontal angle than the straight up vertical that you see. And it's just a canted camera angle, obviously. So it's not quite the achievement that it would appear to be. You know, Evelyn Kraft in this film, who other than one brief scene is clad entirely in this almost non-existent loincloth bikini. Wait a minute, before I get into this, is the scene that I was trying to think of a minute ago where she's bitten by the snake. Again, to talk about the sexual symbolism when he goes and sucks out the poison. I'll leave that for you to, you know, ascertain on your own. It kind of reminds me of a similar scene in a Russ Meyer movie called Motor Psycho that has a similar scene, albeit with the genders reversed. But this is, again, a sequence in the film where the lack of subtlety, I think, is to the film's benefit. This scene with the tiger killing the snake, I don't know if... is that the kind of thing that's going to be censored in British releases of the film? I know that the BBFC in the UK is very sensitive about, you know, any sort of animal abuse on film. Meanwhile, here in the US, we're, you know, watching Cannibal Holocaust and Cannibal Ferox and Italian Jungle Movie atrocity films for the billionth time. So, fortunately, that's the only kind of material like that in this film. Although if you watch other Hong Kong horror films, the mistreatment of animals tends to be a depressingly frequent image. Anyway, Evelyn Kraft, what I was going to say is, you know, she wears the loincloth bikini. She barely, you know, has any kind of audible dialogue for most of the film. And certainly, as a result, her performance is not going to be something that most people would classify as, you know, great acting in any sort of traditional sense of the term. But considering her limited experience and the fact that, you know, she didn't speak Mandarin or Cantonese very well, she was apparently over Hong Kong visiting as a tourist when she was sort of spotted in some sort of newspaper piece by the Shaw Brothers talent people, and they recruited her in to only do two movies over there, this and Deadly Angels. I'll talk about that one in a minute, too. These were the only two films she did in Hong Kong, and she did not have a particularly large career in Europe either. I think she's pretty fantastic in this movie. I mean, she gives it her all. I mean, she is in this 100%, you know, including doing some stunt work that I don't think you know, an inexperienced young actress like her would necessarily be inclined to do. But again, she gives it her all. It's a really committed performance. And in terms of something, you know, you look at acting in her case is really having to kind of deliver in a, I don't want to say pantomime way, but, you know, just in a very making large gestures. I think she does what she does very well in this film. Here we see a return of the sleazy villain character, Ku Feng. I think his character name is Lu Tien in the film. I'm going to be talking about him after I talk about Evelyn Kraft, but it's kind of odd to see him come back in this sequence at the, you know, motel pool. I thought the way that he disappeared in the tent sequence earlier with Danny Lee was kind of vague and enigmatic about him sort of leaving and then coming back here. But anyway, we'll get back to him in a second. God knows there's a lot to unpack with his career. Evelyn Kraft was born in Switzerland in Zurich, September 22nd, 1951. She had a very brief film and television career, almost all entirely confined to the 70s, and not a lot of work in the 70s either. I think she did her last thing. It was a film in 1981. In Russia, I seem to remember correctly. But yeah, that's it. Credited under the name Evelyn Elgar, she's in a pretty fantastic, I love this little bit here where she, again, I mean, just her physical body language in these scenes is really great. The scene where she stands up and gets wobbly and then falls into his arms. Anyway, she's in a really interesting 1972 giallo as Evelyn Elgar called The French Sex Murders. I think it came out in the UK as The Boogeyman and the French Murders by the director Ferdinando Merigi. And she's part of an incredible cast in that movie. I mean, she co-stars with Anita Ekberg, Barbara Boucher, Rosalba Neri, sort of the queens of Italian genre film at that time. Franco veteran Howard Vernon and Gordon Mitchell has effects in it by Carlo Rambaldi years before he was doing the likes of Possession and E.T. She's in a few German comedies in the early mid-70s, about which I confess I know nothing. Her big year was this year, 1977. Mighty Peking Man. I'm sorry again to interject. The slow motion stuff with her and Danny Lee here is really the film at its most surreal. And actually, needless to say, that's a very flattering shot of her. Coming up is a shot that, you know, when I think of Mighty Peking Man, you know how sometimes you'll recall movies in your head and there'll just be one sort of iconic image. That's it for me, is her slow motion twirling around with a leopard or cheetah, whatever it is, I guess a leopard on her shoulders. That's what I think of when I think of Mighty Peking Man. I do not think of the giant ape stomping through models of Hong Kong and Causeway Bay. I think of Evelyn Kraft twirling around with a leopard on her shoulders in slow motion. Anyway, the same year that she did this, she was in another Shaw Brothers movie, an action film called Deadly Angels, which I have not seen. I don't know how easy that is to come across. Probably the other big film she did, though, was director Franz Gottlieb's horror comedy Lady Dracula, where she co-starred with the American actor Brad Harris. After that, she's in a couple other films. Back in Italy, Duccio Tessari's 1978 film, drama called The Fifth Commandment, where she stars with another great cast, Helmut Berger and Udo Kier. But after that film in 81, she pretty much retired from film in the early 80s. She became involved in her husband's realty and construction endeavors. Incidentally, this waterfall, although most of the big nature shots are in India, with the closer, you know, shots done back at studios at Shaw Brothers, this waterfall is in Hong Kong. Obviously not in the city of Hong Kong necessarily, but, you know, in the more natural outskirts. I do not know the exact area, I must confess. I'm going to be talking a little bit more in just a second about some alternate shots, but there's an alternate take of a shot in the slow motion in the lake with the waterfall where there's quite a bit more nudity by her. Let me come back to just, you know, Evelyn Kraft in general, though, and where her career went. She became heavily involved in her husband's realty and construction business, some of which I believe took place in African countries. And in the 90s, I think she was involved in quite a few philanthropic endeavors. Again, she had long retired after out of film and television. She died back in her home country of Switzerland in 2009 at a very unfortunate early age of only 57. She died of heart failure. Anyway, so it's appropriate during this love scene between her and Danny Lee to mention that if you watch the Hong Kong trailer that's included elsewhere on this release, there are two shots. The film in its form here plays very coy with nudity. I mean, it's usually blurred, as you just see there. She's running just out of frame. She has her back to the camera. There's two quite startling shots, one from that waterfall slow motion scene just prior to this, but then a much more blunt, direct, frontal, topless shot of her in the ship cabin that you see later on, where, you know, the nudity is quite obvious in the trailer, yet is not included in the film at all. I mean, presumably they wanted the film to be a more generally family-friendly endeavor, which is understandable. But the shots are there in the trailer. There is a rumor that there is an alternate European version of this, and I've heard discussion of that. But in terms of specifically, there's a German and an older German DVD release that includes the German dubbed release version of the film. And apparently it's the exact I have not seen it. I have been told it's the exact same as the American and the Hong Kong release, Mighty Peking Man and Goliathon. So I don't really think there's a difference there in terms of the nudity, although it is interesting that it wound up in the trailer. I was going to talk about Ku Feng, but why don't I bump up, talk about Danny Lee, since he is the one that we're seeing right now on screen. Give me a moment as I collect my notes, as they say dramatically. Danny Lee, Li Xiaoyin. You know, it's interesting. We tend to think of Hong Kong film as divided between the pre-New Wave kind of traditional period of the Shaw Brothers and the Cathay films of the 60s and 70s. Boom, the Hong Kong New Wave comes in with directors like Choi Hark and Ann Hoy in 1979, films like Butterfly Murders, and then everything after that we think of as the new Hong Kong, as if those two areas of film were somehow like totally different things, you know, sort of the way that we tend to think of South Korean film as being everything before, you know, the sort of international breakthroughs in South Korean film like Shiri and Joint Security Area and Tell Me Something around 1999 and 2000. We tend to think of everything before that and then after that. Well, I mean, Hong Kong, you know, in 1979, in the arrival of the Hong Kong New Wave and the new directors, this leopard is great in this scene, by the way. If there was an animal acting award, the leopard should get it. But no, I mean, it's very much, you know, a continuum. And there are people that, you know, obviously continued to work through the older studio system of the Shaw Brothers in the 60s and 70s, and then continued on in the 80s, 90s, and beyond. And Danny Lee is a classic example of that. He was born in August 6, 1952 in Shanghai. There are quite a lot of people connected with this film who born in Shanghai. However, he moved to Hong Kong very young. I think he was three, moved with his family. He, appropriately enough, given a lot of his later roles, he initially studied to be a police officer, and that did not work out. And he switched to acting, which is, you know, certainly kind of an odd transition to go from police officer to acting. Okay, I'm going to come back to Danny Lee. This obviously is in India. This is the scene that uses the most amount of Indian extras. Apparently, Shaw Brothers coordinated with an Indian film production company at that time to obtain all these extras. There's rear projection there of Mighty Peking Man lurking behind a building that I believe is a hotel, or now a hotel anyway. And this is the transition to when they leave India. But going back to Danny Lee, switched to acting. He entered the Shaw Brothers and then later TVB acting school, again, very young, age of 18. He debuted in 1971 film Deadly Duo, and then in 72, Changche, Water Margin. Had his first sort of bigger role in 1973, River Fury. Biggest role in the 70s was probably 1975's Super Inframan or Inframan by Hoshan, which was a huge, it was an imitation of sort of like the, you know, the Japanese hero films. But that was a big success in many countries, including in the US. When that came out, it had quite a, I don't know how huge it was necessarily in the initial theatrical release, but it had a very long life on video in the U.S. and a big cult following. Lee is in a lot of big Shaw Brothers hits in the 70s, but he wasn't necessarily a major star during the decade. I think you would think of him more as sort of a dependable working actor, a leading man more than a character actor. And in a lot of different genres of film, horror, martial arts, action film. Incidentally, all the stuff you see, I don't think there's anything in Mighty Peking Man that's actually shot on a ship. The ship is a set on the huge Shaw Brothers back lot, intercut with when you see, you know, the ship in the water. It's a model, it's a miniature, which you can kind of tell. But I think, as I said, the model work in the film, I think, is generally pretty good. Anyway, Lee was a solid working actor. He's in the 1973 comedy big hit, House of 72 Tenants. House of 72 Tenants, by the way, was one of the earliest films that Celestial released in their Shaw Brothers restorations. that's one of those movies that's like a big hit in Hong Kong that most people in the West have not really paid attention to, which I think is unfortunate. If you are going to go out of, you know, the normal genre film comfort zone with the Shaw Brothers movies, try and check out House of 72 Tenants. It's a really good movie. He's in All Men Are Brothers, The Big Holdup. He, of course, played Bruce Lee in the 1976, I don't know if you necessarily want to call it a Bruceploitation film, but Bruce Lee and I. He's in another movie by this same director, Ho Meng Hua, that we're going to talk about later. 1976, sort of a horror movie called Oily Maniac. Chor Yun's another film by him, Killer Clans. Again, Cheng Che's Brave Archer, part one and two. However, I think his more significant work is really later on. In 1980, he left his Shaw contract and went independent. A notable film from this time is, it's got a few different titles. You might know it as Heroic Cops. I think the original title is The Executor. And it was also later re-released as Killers 2. I think that was done by Lee's production company. He had a production company that he started himself in the 80s, which is different than the one he had in the 90s that I'll talk about in a minute. Anyway, The Executor, Heroic Cops, is Danny Lee and Chow Yun-fat, a combo that you might know from another film. By the way, this is the moment right here where in the trailer you see a full topless image of Evelyn Kraft that is not here in the theatrical release of the film, version of the film. Anyway, Lee also started directing. He co-directed the 1981 drama One Way Only with Lam Nai Choi. Lam Nai Choi, who is one of my favorite underrated Hong Kong directors. Lam did The Seventh Curse, a movie that I'm going to rave about quite a bit later on. He also did The Erotic Ghost Story and the legendary Ricky O, aka Story of Ricky, which is fantastic. But Lee on his own directed Funny Boys, 1982, and then the 1983 comedy Oh My Cops, starring his future Dr. Lam and Run and Kill star, the portly character actor Kent Chang. Then in 1984, Lee directed a movie called Law with Two Phases, which, you know, it's interesting. Law with Two Phases is not a film that's hugely known in the West, but it was a big film in Hong Kong. It jump-started his career. It was an unusually kind of realistic police thriller, sort of similar to what you got from the grittier fare of 1970s American New Hollywood type films like French Connection. Lee won Best Actor for that film that he also directed at both the Hong Kong Film Awards and Taiwan's Golden Horse Awards. Incidentally, just to interject, this is the only scene where we see Evelyn Kraft not in the loincloth bikini. And, you know, if he was going to buy her a dress, I'm not necessarily sure. Kind of a leather hooker outfit with hot pants would necessarily have been what I would have gone for giving her her, I like that she just chucks it out the porthole and decides to go naked. Anyway, so where was I? Law with Two Phases, Danny Lee. Elsewhere in the 80s, just in terms of an actor, he starred in a great 1987 Ringo Lam film, City on Fire, a movie called The Road Warriors. Let's see. He also, same year, he was at Final Justice, I think. It was that 1989 for Parkman Wong? That was Stephen Chow's first movie, and it was a dramatic role for Stephen Chow. I believe he won a dramatic award for it, and it was Lee. I'm not sure of the, you know, production company affiliations there. I know that Lee was apparently one of Stephen Chow's biggest supporters after doing Final Justice in 89. And then also in 1989, let's just get right to the obvious one. He co-starred with Chow Yun-fat in John Woo's The Killer. He also, just to jump ahead, a couple months later, he was in another film for Woo that Woo co-directed called Just Heroes, which was a benefit generally for the Hong Kong Directors Union, although more specifically for Woo and Lee's old friend, the director Cheng Che, who was embarrassingly at that point flat broke and needed the financial support. Unfortunately, Just Heroes wasn't really much of a hit. But The Killer, 1989, where he co-starred with Chow Yun-fat. Some actually say that Woo's gunplay in those films, Better Tomorrow, Killer, was kind of influenced by Lee's treatment as a director of that same police material in Law of Two Phases. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go into The Killer. The Killer has obviously, you know, been discussed to death. But again, it's interesting that so many people in the UK and the US probably know Danny Lee principally through that film, despite the fact that I think they've probably seen him in a lot of other Shaw Brothers films of the 70s without necessarily making the connection. Like I said, there's, you know, a bunch of overlap there. There's some good work there, the miniature and being thrown about by the waves and the storm. Not long after The Killer, well, in fact, a couple years before that, Lee formed his second production company in 1987 called Magnum Entertainment, I'm not sure. And then that kind of brought forth the weirdest chapter of Danny Lee's career. He was in and involved in, you know, producing and presenting and, you know, in one case co-directing a bunch of Category 3 horror films. Well, horror films also more just sort of like graphically gory police procedurals, often based on real life crimes in Hong Kong. He co-directed a movie in 1992 called Dr. Lam with Simon Yam as the homicidal title character. And he's also in that film again as a police inspector. And then in 1993, he starred in two Category 3 horror films that are to this day infamous and legendary, Run and Kill and The Untold Story. The last one actually, despite being a Category 3 horror film, won Anthony Wong Best Actor Award for playing the maniacal killer in that film. I have a feeling most people listening to this probably already know what Category 3 is, but just in terms of a rating, Category 3 would be the equivalent of an NC-17, formerly an X in the US, or an R-18, I guess it's called in the UK. And it was not something that Hong Kong had for the longest time, even though there were Shaw Brothers movies from the 70s that had quite a lot of sexual and violent content. But Hong Kong didn't at that point have the rating system that they developed. And Category 3 wound up being sort of a short period of time in the 90s, kind of counting down to China regaining control of Hong Kong in 97. It was sort of like that was going to be the last gasp of sexually explicit, ultra-violent graphic films. And Danny Lee was involved with quite a few of those. Like I said, Dr. Lam, Run and Kill, Untold Story. If you were going to name three of the most legendary ones, those would be the three big ones, and as well as, you know, more obviously exclusively sexual stuff like the erotic ghost story movies. Robotrix is a good one. Later on, there's the legendary Anthony Wong movie, Ebola Syndrome. I love this stuff, this footage of the ship arriving in Hong Kong and all these extras on the dock flooding out to point at the arrival of Mighty Peking Man. This is like really dynamic stuff in the movie. Very well done. Again, Lee would continue to star in and in some cases co-produce or present these true life, true crime gore movies, Water Tank Murder Mystery and Portrait of a Serial Rapist, both in 1994. Although also in 1994, he did a really good movie by director Kirk Wong called Organized Crime and Triad Bureau, which is quite good. Again, 94, and that's another one that I feel like has not gotten the attention that it necessarily deserved, although it actually got kind of a decent release in the US at that time. He sort of scaled down his acting work in the 21st century, but he still, you know, here's the actual TVB studios that Shaw Brothers owned. I don't think it is in the same location anymore. I could be wrong, but that was where it was in 77. He worked in mainly cop roles, you know, which was sort of his specialty after he transitioned from sort of a normal straight guy roles in Shaw Brothers movies in the 70s through 2010. Then it seems like he kind of retired, although he's in stuff as recently as 2021, director Elvis Howe's film Anti-Racing Action, which I have not seen, but he has a role in that as well, so he is still working. Before I go back to another actor in the film, Ku Feng, who I talked about earlier, and talk about the director and the screenwriter, both of whom are Shaw Brothers legends, a brief note about the music in this film. Credited, as we go into this tacky production number in the TVB studio, the music in this film is credited to Frankie Chan, Yongyu Chan, who did hundreds of films for Shaw Brothers in actually a pretty narrow period of time, just from the early 70s to, I think, about 1982. But I think, I don't know about what his contributions were for every one of those hundreds of films. Certainly, I'm not an expert in Frankie Chen's career. He has hundreds of credits on Shaw Brothers films. I think a more accurate credit for him would be music supervisor or music producer, because in Mighty Peking Man, as with many of the Shaw Brothers movies during this time period, they were scoring quite a lot of this from the famous DeWolf music library. DeWolf is a British music stock music library, which has been around since almost the beginning of the 20th century and has been involved in providing music for films since the dawn of sound film in 1927. They are used in many, many Hong Kong films, as well as quite a lot of American films. I did a commentary track for George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, and talked about the fact that in addition to the Goblin score for that film, quite a lot of the music in that film is also taken from the DeWolf library. There's even a Romero connection coming up that I'll mention. The slow motion stuff with Danny Lee and Evelyn Kraft in the jungle, I swear to God, I cannot place. The song is called Could It Be Love, and it's credited on the DeWolf library to Frank McDonald and Chris Ray. They also did two other tracks on the Mighty Peking Man soundtrack, The Jam and Wheeling and Dealing. It sounds to me so much like a 70s, like sort of a Vanilla Bland version of a popular 70s American soul song, and I can't place what it is. It's not Could It Be I'm Falling in Love. It doesn't have the same tempo or chords. That duo of Frank McDonald and Chris Ray, I mentioned the George Romero connection. Romero was still using tracks from the DeWolf Music Library in 1982's Creep Show, and they wrote the disco song Don't Let Go that infamously plays in Creep Show. Some of the other DeWolf Library tracks in Mighty Peking Man. Jack Tromby has a track called Suppression. It's also in the Shaw Brothers movie Two Champions of Shaolin. And there's a track called Revolt in this by Eric Towern that is in the first two 36 Chamber movies, 36 Chamber Shaolin, Return to 36 Chamber. There are other tracks in Mighty Peking Man by such other DeWolf Library regular figures as Edward Michael, Vladimir Kosna, and Roger Webb. So that's pretty much the soundtrack to this film, not necessarily original music by Frankie Chen. You know, he's not in this scene right now, but you're going to see him again in a minute. The slimy villain character of Lu Tien is played by Ku Feng. And I want to get into his career, which, you know, if you think I've been talking fast up until now, believe me, it's going to be like lightning in a second. Ku Feng was born in July 3rd, 1930th in Shanghai. He's still alive today. He's in his 90s. He retired only about, I think, 5-6 years ago at the time that I'm recording this. He was born as Chen Siwan and began as a singer with sort of like fairground performance troupes, carnival troupes, things like that in Beijing. He started acting in the 1959 film The Heiress. And again, we'll see him again in a moment. I'll point him out. But if you're wondering, I like the way that was done, by the way, with Evelyn Kraft finding Danny Lee and his former lover, the pan over to the mirror. I thought that was nicely handled. Anyway, if you're wondering what else you've seen Ku Feng in, the answer is every Hong Kong film ever made. He appears in The Count That I Have, from Hong Kong Movie Database, and I've looked at a few other sources, almost 400 films. He's an unbelievable... I don't necessarily know if I can say he is the most prolific character actor in Hong Kong film. I think he's the most prolific character actor, certainly in this era. And he worked for decades and decades. I said he started in 1959 in The Heiress. He signed with Shaw Brothers in 1965. There you see him there in the white suit. That is Ku Feng, villainous figure extraordinaire. And he played many villains. He signed with Shaw Brothers in 1965, though he starred in films for them before that, like the legendary Love Eterne and also La Parade in 1963. Big year for him is 1966. He's in Come Drink With Me, Golden Buddha, Princess Iron Fan for this same director, Magnificent Trio. He is in the One-Armed Swordsman movies, One-Armed Swordsman in 1967, Return of the One-Armed Swordsman 1969, The New One-Armed Swordsman 1971. He's in Killer, Darts, and Golden Swallow in 1968. 1969, he's in Flying Dagger and The Invincible Fist. There's so many hundreds and hundreds of films that you would know him from. I obviously can't name all of them. Just to do a quick rundown, I'm not even going to name years. I'm not even going to name directors. But in the 70s alone, Vengeance, Heroic Ones, Boxer from Shantung, Water Margin, House of 72 Tenants, another one that keeps coming up. All Men Are Brothers, Flying Guillotine and Flying Guillotine 2. Black Magic, another one that keeps coming up. Oily Maniac, another favorite. Killer Clan, Shaolin Temple, Brave Archer 1 and 2. Dream of the Red Chamber, which I mentioned earlier with Sylvia Cheung and Bridget Lin. Five Venoms, Ten Tigers of Kwang Tung, Invincible Kung Fu. Moving into the 1980s, he's in an early John Woo film, Heroes Shed No Tears. He's in Tiger Killer, for which he won a Golden Horse Award in Taiwan, as a supporting actor award. He's in the fantastic Choi Hark historical action comedy, one of my favorites, Picking Opera Blues. He's in Magnificent Warriors. He's in Hong Kong 1941. Again, I'm just going to keep going. He's in Spirit versus Zombie, a hugely popular comedy, Chicken and Duck Talk. Another John Woo movie that I mentioned earlier, Just Heroes. He's in good Ringo Lamb film, Wild Search. And then in the 90s, he's in another one of my favorites, Choi Hark production, Chinese Ghost Story 2. He's in Arrest the Restless. He's in and has a prominent role in a film that another movie that I think is really underrated and has kind of been, I don't want to say forgotten, but not given the attention it should in recent years, Cage Man, which was director Jacob Chung's acclaimed and controversial film. It got a Category 3 rating, but not for any exploitive reasons, just because it was dealing with very difficult subject matter. He's in Erotic Ghost Story. He's in Rose, Rose, I Love You. He's in the Triad movie, Tragic Fantasy, Tiger of Wan Chai. And he's in a couple Jackie Chan movies. He's in City Hunter and then the 2006 Jackie Chan movie, Rob B. Hood or Robin B. Hood, depending on where you're from. And he was working until 2014, 15, 16. Some of his roles then were Real Iron Monkey and Mad Monk Ji Gong. There he is again, smoking a cigar in the white suit. The consummate character actor in Hong Kong films for decades and decades, Ku Feng. And someone should make a documentary about him and him alone. He is a remarkable, remarkable figure. Okay, let's talk about the director of this film, Ho Meng Hua, who ridiculously is sometimes credited in, I think, some prints of this movie as Homer Goff, as an anglicized pseudonym, despite the fact that I don't know of anyone that actually is named Homer Goff. He was born in 1923, grew up in Shanghai, and then moved to Hong Kong in 1948 or 1949. It's interesting. Reading up about him, it seemed as if he joined Shaw Brothers in 1955 as a screenwriter, but he was simultaneously, this seems odd to me, but I confirmed it in a couple things. It seemed like he was simultaneously working as an assistant director for rival studio Cathay during this time period on films like Miss Kikuko and Rainstorm in Chinatown. But he made his directing debut in 1958 with Appointment After Dark, and then did over 50 films for Shaw Brothers. You know, it's interesting because we're talking about, you know, the transition between pre-Hong Kong New Wave and post-Hong Kong New Wave. It's also funny what some directors are known for, you know, in the West or in the minds of some fans, and what, you know, they're actually known for in Hong Kong. I foolishly, for many years, kind of associated Ho Meng Hua with horror films and fantasy films because of this and because of the Black Magic films and Oily Maniac, a couple other things I'm going to talk about in a minute. In Hong Kong, he's known principally for the four Monkey King movies that he made between 1966 and 68. I mean, that quartet is hugely famous. Monkey Goes West, Princess Iron Fan, Cave of the Silken Web, which is a wonderful movie. That's actually my favorite of those. And finally, Land of Many Perfumes. Those are the films that I think he's probably principally known for in Hong Kong. After he did Appointment After Dark in 1958, he did Till the Clouds Roll By in 1961, and then another quartet of films in 1964 alone, To Catch a Murderer, My Lucky Star, The Adulteress, A Maid from Heaven. Did Flying Guillotine, one of those films that keeps coming up over and over again, in 1975. And then, like I said, I sort of always thought of him as you know, a director of fantasy and horror films and thrillers. He did Kiss of Death in 1973, which is a little more lackluster in its pacing than I would have preferred, but it's an interesting film by him prior to the fantastic Black Magic and Black Magic 2 in 75 and 76, which are two of my favorite Shaw Brothers horror films. Very eerie, creepy, and yet also have spectacular visuals. Speaking of spectacular visuals, here we go with the full model work of, you know, Mighty Peking Man running amok. I think he starts out at Causeway Bay in Hong Kong. And the miniature model work, I'm going to talk about the Japanese guys that did that in just a second. But Ho Meng Hua also did The Psychopath in 1978. He left Shaw Brothers in 1980. His final film there was Swift Sword. And then he did one independent film also in the same year, Mr. Kwong Tung and the Robber. And then, this seems like a very strange credit to me, but again, I've checked and this is apparently the way it is. He didn't direct for 12 years, and then he came back in 1992 to direct his final film, which is a Category 3 erotic horror film called Evil Black Magic in 92, and that was his last work as a director. He died on May 19th, 2009, at the age of 86 in Hong Kong. I should probably, since we're really getting into some of the best miniature and model effects work, talk about those guys for a second, and then I'll come back to another key figure in Mighty Peking Man. For the effects, the Shaw Brothers went to craftsmen in Japan to do all the spectacular model and miniature effects work. Oh God, what is the line here? Played for comedy, my wife is a gorilla or something like that. That's yeah, kind of a cringe inducing line in the movie. Anyway, all the stuff, the gas station blowing up, fabulous model work. The Japanese artist that did the effects, one of the Japanese artists, the effects supervisor, Sadamaga Aikawa, who is the special effects photographer for all the key kaiju and Japanese monster movies around this time period, the original Godzilla, Mothra, King Kong versus Godzilla, the fantastic 1963 movie Matango, aka Attack of the Mushroom People, which is one of my favorite Japanese genre films. I love that movie. I have to say, the demise of this character here with Mighty Peking Man stomping on him could have been a little bloodier. I would have preferred to have seen, maybe given the loathsome nature of that attempted rapist character, I wouldn't have minded seeing something more terrible happen to him. Anyway, Sadamaga Akawa also did the effects work. He worked in effects in various capacities. Sometimes he's credited as effects photographer. Sometimes he's uncredited on a few of these movies. Mothra vs. Godzilla, Latitude Zero, H-Man, a lot of movies. You've seen Mysterians, Varan, Ghidorah, Son of Godzilla, Space Amoeba, the famous All Monster Bash, Destroy All Monsters. And then right after Peking Man, Mighty Peking Man, I think it was in 78, he went on to do the effects work for the legendary TV series Monkey, which was hugely popular in the UK as well as other territories. Also doing the effects in this film, less the model and miniature photography and more the, I believe the actual ape suit and the animatronic work on Mighty Peking Man himself is the Japanese effects artist Kizo Murase. I apologize if, as with some other names on this, my pronunciation is 100%. He's still working today. And he was involved in, as I said, the ape suit that you see here and the effects work. He worked on some of the same films that I just mentioned, H-Man, Mothra, Varan, King Kong versus Godzilla, Mothra versus Godzilla, the aforementioned fantastic Matango, Ghidorah, multiple Gamera films and multiple Daimajin films, as well as Terror of Mechagodzilla and the 90s Godzilla films like Godzilla versus Mothra and Godzilla versus King Ghidorah. But in addition to those Japanese movies, he did something else in Hong Kong, which is the aforementioned horror movie that I dearly love from 1986, The Seventh Curse, which write your congressman, write your parliament, write your politicians, demand a spectacular Blu-ray special edition of The Seventh Curse. It's one of the best Hong Kong horror films of the 80s. And it's got Chow Yun-Fat and Maggie Cheung in it to boot. So those were the very talented Japanese craftsmen responsible for the effects in Mighty Peking Man. I'm nervous because we're getting to the home stretch here and there's still a lot that I wanted to talk about. I hope I didn't spend too much time extolling the virtues of Evelyn Craft early on. Speaking of which, as she climbs that light pole, I believe that her climbing the light pole and jumping off, she actually is substituted by a stunt person there. Yeah, that shot where she's jumping off, that's not her, although I love the landing shot. We should certainly talk about, and again, this is one of those cases where I cannot name all of this person's credits. The writer of this film, Ni Kuang, is one of the most prolific and legendary writers in Hong Kong. There's so many hugely talented people involved with this film, and Ni Kuang would be right at the top of the list. He was born in Ningbo on May 10th, 1935, although he was raised, another one that was raised in Shanghai. He left for Hong Kong in 1957. He worked for the Chinese government for a while and has been notoriously anti-communist throughout much of his career. Again, talking about how people are known in the West versus what they're also known for in Hong Kong, I think, in the US and the UK, you would principally know Ni Kuang as the preeminent writer of wuxia films, historical martial arts films, and he is that without question. But he is also a prominent science fiction novelist, a political essayist. He created the Wisely series, which has gone for, I think, about 150 stories that he personally wrote. I think there are some that are also written by others. Published his first novel in 1957, his first science fiction novel in 1962. He is responsible for about 300 novels and 400 film scripts. He is one of the most prolific writers that you could possibly imagine. He can write up to 4,500 characters an hour. And the amount of films that he has worked on is absolutely jaw-dropping. Maybe, I mean, I'm talking about several of the other collaborators on this film being so prolific outside of their work on Mighty Peking Man. He is the king in that category. I cannot name all the films that he worked on, and particularly given that we're reaching the end of the film, but I'm sure you're familiar with One-Armed Swordsman, Vengeance, Heroic Ones, Boxer from Shangtung, Water Margin. Again, these are some of the same big Shaw Brothers titles that have come up over and over again with these people. Prodigal Boxer, Blood Brothers, All Men Are Brothers, Flying Guillotine, here we go again. Black Magic 1 and 2, here we go again. Spiritual Boxer, Killer Clans, Executioners from Shaolin, the wonderful 77 movie, same year, Chinatown Kid, that I was talking about how much I loved earlier. The Shaw Brothers Best, 36 Chamber, Shaolin, and Return of 36 Chamber, Five Venoms, Crippled Avengers, Dirty Ho, Mad Monkey Kung Fu, Eight Diagram Pole Fighter, one from the 80s, sort of like one of the last gasps of Shaw Brothers greatness. He's also occasionally an actor in later films. He's not in Mighty Peking Man, but he crops up in Seventh Curse, for which he's also credited as the story writer. He, again, as I mentioned, is very famously anti-communist, and in fact he relocated to the U.S. in 1992 with the takeover of Hong Kong by China again looming in 1997, although he ultimately apparently did move back in 2006. He is still with us. I can't help but wonder, with all of the protests and activity in Hong Kong these days, what his position is on Hong Kong and the Chinese government, and what his relationship is to Hong Kong. We see, as the film starts to wrap up, Mighty Peking Man, he's climbing to the top of the, it's a real building that's still there in Hong Kong, the Connaught Center. It's now called the Jardine House. At the time, in 1977, it was the tallest building in Hong Kong, although that was supplanted by the Hopewell Center in 1980, just 3 years after this film. Incidentally, that white guy there, sorry, that white guy there, that was blunter than I wanted it to be. The white military captain, sergeant, whatever he is played by an actor named Ted Thomas, who is more commonly known in Hong Kong as a Big Dubber, voice artist for many Hong Kong films being dubbed into English. I'm going to wrap this up in just a minute by talking about some of the other significant Shaw Brothers horror and fantasy films that I would recommend in addition to Mighty Peking Man, which is sort of a borderline horror film, actually. But I would be remiss if I didn't point out, because I didn't mention this earlier when I was talking about the U.S. release for the film. You know, it came out in 1980 through World North as Goliathon, but it was re-released in 1999. By Rolling Thunder, which was the short-lived division of Miramax that they had kind of given Quentin Tarantino to release genre films, mostly re-release genre films that were to his liking. Unfortunately, it didn't last longer than a couple years, but they did some really good work in that brief period of time, in addition to Mighty Peking Man, which developed a stronger cult following as a result of the 1999 re-release on the Midnight Film Circuit. They also did another more contemporary, obviously, Hong Kong film, Wong Kar-wai's masterpiece, Chungking Express. And then a couple American exploitation films from the 70s that were also quite good. They did Arthur Marx's Detroit 9000 and, even better, Jack Hill's Switchblade Sisters, which, you know, was also very good. And also, I think, developed a renewed cult following as a result of the Tarantino re-release. This stuff with Mighty Peking Man on top of the building, which I love the stuff with the helicopters. I think there's also some, you know, more great model and miniature work coming up. And I do find, you know, this ending to be, as I was saying earlier, you know, sometimes when you hit big, you know, it does work. And I think that, you know, the melodramatics and operatic tone of the ending of the film, I think is, you know, for me, affecting and more effective than the similar ending, obviously, of King Kong atop the World Trade Center in the Dino De Laurentiis remake by John Guillermin the previous year. Anyway, Shaw Brothers obviously are mostly known in the West for the martial arts films, either the Wushu period piece historical films or the contemporary fare like Chinatown Kid. In Hong Kong, they're just as known for comedies, dramas, musicals, Lee Hun Shang stuff in the 60s, you know, that are legendary in Hong Kong, not as much known in the US and the UK. They didn't do a ton of horror and fantasy films, but the ones they did are some of the most memorable examples to come out of that genre in Hong Kong. I mentioned by Ho Meng Hua the Black Magic and Black Magic 2 films from 75 and 76. Those are really good places to start. Oily Maniac, also by him with Danny Lee, maybe not so much. It's kind of a more uneven movie, although it's very, very entertaining. But the Black Magic films are kind of seminal films in Hong Kong horror fantasy, and that's a good place to begin. 1982, there's one they did, Human Lanterns, by Chung Sun, the director. That's also worth a look. 75, Killer Snakes, is kind of a memorable one, although I'm going to talk about that in just a second when I talk about the director. There's a couple that I haven't seen. In 79, they did one called Return of the Dead, which is an anthology horror film in the vein of Creepshow and that kind of thing by Lee Hun Song, who I just mentioned. I have not seen that one, nor have I seen the 1975 one by Jang Il-ho called Night of the Devil's Bride in English. Would like to check those out. There's one that I actually just watched from 1981. I watched recently called Bloody Parrot by Shan Hua, the director, which might, it has a tremendous last 10 or 15 minutes, something that it shares with a movie that I'm going to talk about in a minute, Seating of a Ghost. But Bloody Parrot is also notable for being perhaps, oh, and that's written by the same writer, I should point out. It's one of the most incoherent, difficult to decipher stories I've ever come across in a Shaw Brothers film, although it has some fantastic stuff in the end. Like I said, that's also characteristic it shares with the 1983 Kyun Young film Seating of a Ghost. That film was held up as sort of the best Hong Kong horror film for a long time in the 90s when people first started becoming reinterested in this stuff in the West on VHS and stuff. Seating of a Ghost has a fantastic last 10 or 15 minutes, and up to that is a lot more uneven in its pacing. It's still very much worth seeing because the last 10 or 15 minutes are absolutely astonishing, but it's a little bit of a long road to get there. Shaw Brothers also did a film, blanking out on the year, early 80s, I think, called Lost Souls by a director, T.F. Mouse, M-O-U-S, who's more famous for doing the really notorious, infamous, and difficult World War II atrocity film, Men Behind the Sun. Lost Souls isn't really a horror film per se. It's actually kind of a grim urban drama, but it has some of the same confrontational, difficult to take imagery as some of the Shaw Brothers horror films. The best Shaw Brothers horror director is actually Kwai Chi Hung, who was kind of their in-house exploitation specialist. He is known for doing the women in prison exploitation movie, Bamboo House of Dolls. Love that shot of the flaming helicopter going down and hitting the fuel truck, that model exploding. I think that's fantastic. Bamboo House of Dolls in 1973, the Shaw Brothers entry in the women in prison exploitation subgenre. And he did, as I mentioned earlier, the 1974 horror film Killer Snakes for them, which is another legendary one that's worth seeing. Big series of films from 1980 to 1982, the Hex films, trilogy Hex, Hex versus Witchcraft, and Hex After Hex, which are all very much worth seeing. Around the same time period, he did Bewitched, Corpse Mania. These are pretty readily available in English-friendly form, and I would suggest checking those out. Another thing called Curse of Evil, but the one that you really need to know Kuei Chi Hung for in terms of Shaw, the best Shaw Brothers horror film, period, bar none, as far as I'm concerned. One of the best Hong Kong horror films, one of the best horror films, period, is the director's penultimate achievement in 1983. He did a movie called Boxer's Omen, which is, you know, I talk about films like Seating of a Ghost having some of their horror imagery that they're known for really kind of being limited to third act climaxes and that kind of thing. Boxer's Omen, almost through the entirety of its running time, is a nonstop barrage of almost hallucinatory imagery on par with, if you can imagine a Hong Kong horror, I mean, it's set in Thailand, but if you can imagine a Hong Kong horror film in the style of Jodorowsky, that's what you're looking at with some of the incredible imagery in Boxer's Omen. That is the achievement in Shaw Brothers horror, as far as I'm concerned, and one of my favorite horror films of all time. So definitely worth seeing that one. Kuei Chi Hung, I feel bad in the last minutes of Mighty Peking Man talking about another director's work, but I'll come back to this. Kuei Chi Hung did only one other movie after that, a 1984 comedy called Misfire. Then he apparently didn't really get along well in the Shaw Brothers assembly line system of filmmaking, and he kind of left unhappily, moved to the U.S. and opened a pizzeria, believe it or not, and then died in 1999, once again, at the far too young age of 61. So these are some of the closing minutes of Mighty Peking Man. You know, amidst all the sort of ridiculousness and absurdity of some of the, you know, high moments in the movie, one thing Mighty Peking Man really has, despite the fact that we're going into a very tragic ending here with Evelyn Kraft, this is also kind of a reversal of, you know, normal King Kong films. It's not, you know, Beauty killed the Beast or whatever. I believe the Evelyn Kraft character dies, as well as Mighty Peking Man, at the end of the film. Of the shot of the this version of the film, in any case, Danny Lee is carrying her body, what I think is her lifeless body. It's left a little bit ambiguous, but that's how I perceived it. But one thing Mighty Peking Man has is a great sense of fun, you know, a great sense of entertainment, a great sense of spectacle without the ponderous pomposity associated with that, that is, I think, afflicted so many blockbuster type films in recent decades. You know, I mean, so many blockbusters today that deal with this kind of, you know, grand fantasy, it's almost as if they're these sort of bloated, overlong, self-serving dinosaurs where they feel they have to elevate the film to, you know, some kind of tragedy with a ponderous subtext, as if they're taking, you know, the Joseph Campbell mythology books too seriously. By the way, speaking of spectacle and blockbusters, this explosion through the building here done on the Shaw Brothers sets is really top-notch. I mean, this is like something you would see out of, you know, a big Hollywood film today without, again, the bloated sense of pomposity and spectacle. Not everything has to be a thematically weighty rock opera. Sometimes there's a lot to be said for a great 2 or 3 minute pop song. And that's sort of the equivalent of what Mighty Peking Man is in the world of genre movies and monster movies compared to what we have today. You know, I talked earlier about, you know, how sometimes it's viewed as campy spectacle. And I think sometimes, you know, we kind of overcorrect serious genre criticism in the way that we look at these movies. Sometimes, like I said, with kind of a condescending, derisive tone, you know, a little bit of a patronizing look at movies like this that, you know, play it very large and, you know, over the top. But, you know, I'll take Mighty Peking Man over any Hollywood special effects, you know, fantasy spectacle that is made today. As I mentioned, it has a sense of exuberance, a spirit, a sense of fun. knows how to tell a story with the utmost economy and efficiency. And, you know, it's just one of the Shaw Brothers' most entertaining and fondly remembered films of the 70s. Here we are at the end, far too quickly for my taste. This has been Mighty Peking Man. Again, I'm Travis Crawford. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy the film and the talk as much as I did.